the three characteristics of existence: impermanence, not self, and suffering. In Pali, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Another way of formulating this might be to say, things change, we change, and usually this brings suffering. So yesterday, Gill spoke about impermanence. You know, the law of change and how we relate to it. This equation of impermanence times clinging equals suffering. When we cling to something that's impermanent, we suffer. So today I would like to talk about this suffering, so-called suffering, the characteristic of dukkha, which is one of the third characteristics, and it's also the first noble truth. Sometimes it's erroneously translated as life is suffering, which is great for newspaper cartoon writers and things like that. I like that line of, you know, as Buddhists, we say life is suffering, and then we come on retreat to prove it. So, dukkha is often translated as suffering, but that's not quite it, or that doesn't quite capture it. I think one of the issues is that there's not one word in English that corresponds to the word dukkha. You know, of course it includes the suffering, the obvious suffering that we think about. Unpleasant, difficult, painful experiences are dukkha, are included in dukkha. You know, these are the big ones. Loss, trauma, physical pain, emotional pain. You know, we don't have to look far to see that there's tremendous suffering in the world. You know, and of course, because of impermanence, it's something that can come on very suddenly. One thing that comes to my mind is the earthquake and the tsunami that happened in Japan in 2011. My wife is Japanese, and we were living in Tokyo at the time. I was actually at Spirit Rock, but she was in Tokyo, and to hear her describe the what you think is so solid, the sidewalk, the street, everything just moving, and these huge buildings swaying, you know, and then of course, you know, finding out about the tens of thousands of people who were just swallowed by the ocean. You know, so there's tremendous suffering in the world. There's violence, we know this. All it takes is to open the newspaper. I promise the talk will get more optimistic. You know, so within this term dukkha is included something that's more subtle. You know, it's not only this kind of suffering that can knock us off of our feet. but it can also include something about this basic sense of unsatisfactoriness, you know, unsatisfactoriness that runs through life. You know, it's the sense of something that feels just a little bit off, something that's a little bit out of alignment. You know, it. I think about it as a kind of friction, you know, or a sense of unease, a kind of something's missing. And I don't know if that resonates with you, if that feels familiar. But I also think it's something that we can easily see when we meditate, when we sit. You know, so what happens on the cushion is a microcosm. And you know, something about, you know, when we sit, is there something that we want to happen? You know, is there something that we want to stop happening? Some kind of subtle rejection of what we're experiencing right now. That's dukkha. It can manifest as a kind of bracing against life. You know, or restlessness. You know, leaning forward into something. This, you know, it can be very subtle, of just wanting something to happen. So, you know, right there is this truth of dukkha. You know, as Gil said this morning, this sense of looking for it. You know, I'm looking for it, and all I know for sure is that whatever this isn't it. I'm familiar with that. You know, also it can manifest as this sense of the grass is always greener, you know. There's some other technique, there's some other teacher, there's some other meditation center. You know, once I go to Burma, you know. You know, IRC is okay, but, you know, it's not Burma. This sense of waiting, you know, Gil talked about waiting, you know, waiting for something. You know, once I get X, then, you know, once I have that experience, or once I have the, you know, the perfect job, or once I find true love, then I can be happy, then I can live, then I can really practice. You know, that's dukkha. That's dukkha. You know, so we sacrifice what's here for the promise of, you know, the fantasy of the next thing. This sense of dukkha is given such an important place in the Buddha's teachings that it's said that the Buddha said, "I," encapsulating his teaching, he said, "I teach one thing, which is dukkha. Dukkha and the end of dukkha." So, you know, something that's really central, something that's really important to understand and come to terms with. So a question is dukkha personal? You know, we know that there are certain kinds of dukkha that we share, that all human beings share. But it can also be very tempting to think that there's other kinds of dukkha that's so personal, that's so inside my head, inside, you know, no one could understand that. It's so specific to me, you know, my problems. And I would just suggest to check out that assumption. You know, it's like, you know, I don't think the same thoughts as you, but I know what it is to think. You know, I know what thinking is. I may not judge myself in the same ways that you do, but I know what self-judgment is. And so along these lines, the teaching of the Buddha is that this characteristic of dukkha is universal. All conditioned phenomena are dukkha. Even more radical, this teaching of in some way anything that can be felt is included within dukkha. So this is something that's universal. It's the way things are. As Joseph Goldstein often says, it's not a mistake. The first time I heard that, I said, well, wait a second. But it's not a mistake. This is nature. And so as a universal characteristic, defining dukkha as suffering, with the word suffering, doesn't really fit so well, because there are, we know there's certain kinds of experience that is pleasant. There's certain kinds of change that's pleasant. When something that's unpleasant changes into something that's pleasant, it's a little bit of a stretch to call that suffering. So in this case, a translation of dukkha that may be closer to the mark is dukkha as unsatisfying, dukkha as unreliable, or something that's uncertain. So it's like all phenomena has, all conditions have this quality of being unsatisfying in some way, of being unreliable in some way. And so then the question is, in what way, are they unsatisfying? In what way are they not dependable and not reliable? And I think the key to this is in impermanence. So if we think about it, if all phenomena is constantly changing and it doesn't last, then it can't provide a lasting happiness. When we cling to something and we try to make it last, that's a recipe for suffering. So something about the insight that satisfaction doesn't reside in the object. I think this is something that we all half get and half forget. One example that I think about from my own life is my relationship to coffee. I like coffee. I like the smell of it. I like the idea of it. I like some way the way it makes me feel. And so, like, when I wake up in the morning, I think about coffee. And but whenever I drink coffee, it's never quite as good as I expected it to be. Or quite as good as I think it's going to be. And on top of that, it messes up my stomach. And my wife is like, why are you drinking coffee? And, it happens over and over. I think I learn. So we're like this, and we tend to be object-oriented. We're focused on an object. We think there's some satisfaction within the object. But often, once we get the object of desire, it doesn't satisfy. Another example, I think, is when I was in junior high school, I was really into tennis. And I was taking tennis. Taking tennis lessons, as all good boys in Brooklyn do, and I, I, th- I, I saw some people playing with this tennis racket, one of those new rackets at the time that was very thick, and you know, it gives you a lot of power. And I thought, oh, if only I had that tennis racket. And then I saved up money, and it cost like $100 or something, and I saved it for a long time. And I took the subway into Manhattan, you know, not telling my parents or anything, and went to the sporting goods store and, you know, bought this tennis racket. And I didn't tell my parents, and I came home. And then we were going to visit family in California, and I packed my bags and got all my bags together. And with it was this new tennis racket. And they were like, where is this come from? And, you know, I'm not sure if I ever play tennis with it. Something about it, it was enough to have the racket. It's like... The other example I think of is, it's like if you imagine the most comfortable chair or the most comfortable sofa, you know, something not like one of these zafus that's hard as a rock, you know, but something really, really comfortable. And you just sit on it and you get really, really comfortable and just really, really relax, and you just sink into it. And it feels great. And then imagine staying in that position. You know, okay, it feels great for 10 minutes. You know, maybe you take a nap. How long can you nap? You know, an hour, 2 hours. At some point, that's going to start feeling uncomfortable. You know, it's like what was pleasant becomes unpleasant. And I think about this with all kinds of material pleasures and satisfactions. You know, it could be the greatest meal, the greatest tasting food. But if we eat and eat and eat and gorge ourselves to the point of feeling sick, it's not so pleasant anymore. So something about this, what's pleasant, sooner or later will change into being unpleasant. You know, this is impermanence. And I think a big part of our basic conditioning is we want what's pleasant, and we want to avoid what's unpleasant. You know, and this can often be one of the central themes that runs through our life. You know, you know, this constant trying to get what we want and trying to avoid what we don't want. Whether it's very clear and obvious or very subtle, it's a kind of controlling our experience, a kind of manipulation that we all do. The truth of life is impermanence. You know, everything changes, we change. You know, we'll be separated from the people we care about. You know, the people we love will die. We'll die, you know. Is it possible to be happy, you know, in the face of this truth? What I would say is that if we resist, if we deny the reality of change, we suffer. If our happiness depends on conditions being a certain way, on lining everything up to just be just right, sooner or later, those conditions will change, and we suffer. Eventually, we suffer. And I think of a few kinds of dukkha. There's the kind that's, you know, I would say non-optional, you know, including aging, sickness, death, you know, And then there's the optional dukkha, some kind of resisting. From the grossest to the most subtle movement of mind that clings. The most subtle movement of mind that clings. So one question I think that can often be helpful to ask is, is there dukkha here? Is dukkha present? I think it's often expressed as a kind of struggle or as a tension in the body. Something is not being open to. Some sense of unease. Some expectation we have about, who we are or how life should be. Some expectation is not being met. And what I would say is that because dukkha is a truth, a characteristic, it's not something that we try to get rid of. It's not something that can be gotten rid of. But rather, it's something in this practice to meet with wisdom, something to be understood. So how can we understand it? How can we meet it in a way that's not depressing, that's not one thing I don't think it is just to say it's all dukkha, there's no joy, there's no appreciation in life, what's the point? It's just dukkha. That's actually just aversion. So that can't be it. So what does it mean to understand dukkha? What does it mean to actually meet it with wisdom? What I would say is the key to this, and the key to finding freedom, is something about looking at our relationship to dukkha. And we begin to look at this by looking at all the ways that we push it away, that we deny it, that we resist it. So something about beginning to accept our life on its own terms. Something about giving up this precious project of trying to make things different than they are, and trying to it's like this sense of what's here is wrong. So one way of approaching this is what we're doing. It's like showing up and being present for it, really meeting this truth in our own experience. We've talked often about this image of the muddy pond or the cloudy glass of water, that the more we try to stir it up, the more we do something, it just becomes more cloudy. So something about, making room for it, you know, leaving something alone, or letting something settle. You know, so to really meet this, to really, I think of the word respect, something about respecting the suffering, respecting the unease, and to really meet it, to really be here for it, to really feel what's there. You know, when we actually do that, when we can make room for things as they are, you know, we can begin to discover something, you know, some kind of peace, some kind of peace, some love, some freedom, some perfection that's right in the middle, you know, that's been here this whole time. You know, it's like, in this way, everything is Buddha. Everything is included, even our suffering. And something funny starts to happen, that all the things that we think of as problems in our life, it's not that they go away, but it's like, you know, they're not problems so much in the same way anymore. It's like, it's just us, you know, it's just me. You know, we're not separate from our problems. We're not separate from our dukkha. And then in this way, dukkha begins to become a dharma door. Something interesting starts to happen, you know, when we meet dukkha, when we meet our own unease, our own suffering, with a heart that's open. What arises naturally, kind of automatically, is compassion. You know, this vast compassion. And something important about understanding that what we struggle with in the meditation is not something to get past, you know. So, you know, it's like, once I get through this, then I can really practice. It's like, you know, with this shift comes the understanding that the struggles and the difficulties actually are the practice. We've been in it, we've been doing it all this time. And so through meeting dukkha with wisdom, with compassion, with presence, you know, we can discover a beautiful ease, you know, a beautiful contentment. Meaningful teachings of my own lineage, you know, that I get from Gil and from his teacher and from his teacher, is this sense of, this expression of contentment. That just to be alive is enough. Just to be alive is enough. This moment is enough. You know, and then it's like, you know, this question we have, you know, is this it? Is this it? Something in us knows the answer, which is that each moment is it. Each moment is actually it. We don't have to wait at the side of the road. It's like, we didn't miss it. It's just that each moment of our life is it. Maybe let's sit for a few minutes.